key. Oh yeah, alright, take it easy baby, make it last all night. She was an American girl.
This is Deborah Craddock, a podcast where we sit down with everyday Americans and hear their extraordinary stories. I'm your host, Deborah Drucker. Come along with me as we discuss those things that we were always told not to talk about. Politics, religion, and more. I promise you'll be inspired and have your mind opened by the end of this episode.
Well, it was kind of cold that night. She stood alone on the balcony. Yeah, she could hear the cars roll by out on 441, like waves crashing on the beach.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Deborah Craddock. Today on Deborah Craddock, we are going to get to know David Vanderveen. David is an entrepreneur who has had major success in the field of health and energy drinks. He is a surfer, a father, a husband, and a writer. David is a unique individual who always brings the fun and can also mix up a great cocktail. Now, let's find out how this American boy became the man that he is today. Hey, David.
Wow, Deborah, that was really cool. Thanks for inviting me on the podcast, and thanks for such a great intro.
Well, I'm so happy that you're here, and we're going to get to the start of it. I know you live in Laguna Beach, Florida, and Paris now, but where are you originally from?
I was born in Detroit, or as the French say, Detroit. My dad was in med school and then transferred to Johns Hopkins, so we were in Baltimore for a little while, and then because of the Vietnam War, he had to serve in the Air Force, so we lived in D.C., and then we moved back to West Michigan, where my father's from, and he had a medical practice there. So I mostly grew up in West Michigan, sort of the Dutch-American Riviera, which we say jokingly. And then I went to college in Chicago and then lived in Japan and then moved out west. Yeah, so that's where I'm sort of from. And my wife Sarah and I have lived the longest part of our lives here in Southern California. We lived in the Napa Valley for 8 years and Seattle for a couple of years, but mostly here in Laguna Beach.
And that's a funny coincidence because I was born in Mount Clemens, Michigan.
See, all the best people are born in Michigan.
Thank you very much. I'll take that. So who did you grow up with there in Michigan?
My parents, my dad's a head and neck specialist. My mom was a nurse. She stopped practicing when we had kids. We had six kids, which is kind of funny. When Sarah and I first got married and got pregnant, it's kind of quicker than we were anticipating. We called my parents. Sarah was a little upset because she was working and wanted to have a career. And you know, probably that wasn't going to work very well if we had kids. So we called, my mom starts laughing and we're like, why are you laughing? And she said, well, we only tried to have one kid, you know, your older brother, and everybody else was a mistake. Like it was in the 60s, there were a lot of different birth control methods. And so they were, you know, she said, you know, we didn't really think you'd get pregnant if you were breastfeeding, but then you came along and then, you know, and it was one kind of method after another. So we had six kids. I grew up in West Michigan, you know, a lot of kind of Dutch immigrant roots there. I remember living in like Baltimore and DC and, you know, being white Anglo-Saxon was kind of unusual. And we moved to West Michigan and it's like the norm and everyone's kind of from the same place. And at first it felt very refreshing, like, wow, my people. But then it started to feel pretty parochial. And, you know, by the time I got to high school, I wanted to sort of move on as quickly as like, although I love West Michigan, I didn't want to, you know, stay there.
You just wanted more diversity?
Yeah, I wanted a bigger palette, you know, people with maybe a little broader sense of ideas.
And how many generations are you American? How far does it go back?
Yeah, on my mom's side, my grandmother immigrated. On my dad's side, my great-grandfather immigrated, or my great-grandparents on both sides. So, you know, a couple generations out of Sarah's mom immigrated after the war.
So you're both Dutch.
Yeah, these Dutch immigrant communities kind of cling together. And you know, the Protestant Reformation was sort of fought in the Netherlands against Spain for about 80 years. And so the Dutch have this like Dutch Reformed or Dutch Christian Reformed Protestant tradition that we're all sort of born into. And it creates these sort of cultural enclaves that, you know, we have like our own schools and it gets a little clingy.
So you grew up with five siblings?
I did. Yeah, I was the second of five.
And how's the combination, boys and girls?
It's three and three. The first three were about 2 years apart, and then there's a four-year gap, and then there were three more. So my older brother and I broke a lot of trail for everybody else. And then, you know, I think it was a lot easier for the younger ones to kind of navigate life.
Yeah, you paved the way.
Yeah.
So was that older brother who you were closest with?
Yeah, we shared a bedroom. We fought every day, unless somebody picked on one of us, and then we'd go beat them up. Yeah, so I grew up, you know, sort of fighting a lot just because that's what boys tend to do sometimes. And then he and I ended up doing some things after college, but he died fairly young. He died when he was 23 from leukemia.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah, no, thank you. So yeah, so I was very close with him. My sister, who's 2 years younger than me, is probably my closest sibling, although, you know, we all get along pretty well just because we ended up doing more things together. We didn't fight very much, and she's a lot easier to hang with.
So it was a fun upbringing.
We lived on a lake next to a yacht club and had access to a lot of nice things. I always thought we were poor because a lot of our neighbors did better than my father was a doctor. You know, they owned businesses and things. But, you know, looking back, we were doing just fine and had a pretty nice life.
Yeah. Wonderful. And that's why you're such a happy-go-lucky person, maybe.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, yeah, we traveled a lot as a family. I think, you know, travel is a great gift. I think functional parents is a great gift. Education's a great gift. Those things really pay dividends later in life. And I've learned to be very grateful for a lot of that, even though at the time, you know, didn't love the piano lessons, didn't like being forced to race sailboats, but down the road, it becomes something that really makes life, you know, pretty nice.
Well, it sounds like a wonderful upbringing and a great situation. I mean, sailboats and big trips. It sounds great. I'm sure for the listeners out there, it sounds really intriguing.
How about you? Did you play sports or do?
I did. Music? I was on track and field.
Oh, yeah.
And I was a gymnast.
Oh, wow.
And those were my sports at the time. And then I discovered boys and everything was about that at that point. Music, they tried to get me to play the piano, but I didn't have an aptitude for it or the patience. And now I'm kind of like, why didn't you make me do it more? I wanted to ask you also, was it a political household?
So in our tradition, so we go to church twice on Sunday. Sunday afternoons, you argue about everything. And it's kind of a healthy, I think it's, you know, we love each other, but you have these, like, it kicks off with either religion or politics. Our family, most of the people in West Michigan are pretty conservative. My father, my grandparents, very active in the Republican Party. You know, my mother and grandmother were very active with Phyllis Schlafly, who historically, if you look back, maybe isn't somebody that a lot of people would love. I kind of, as a rebel, went libertarian, which is, you know, nobody even knows what that is, more or less.
I'm still not sure.
Yeah, I just didn't want the government in my wallet or my bedroom. Just wasn't a fan of big government in general. But that's sort of what yours, you know, rolled into naturally there. And to not be a Republican, to not go to college, to not go through with all that, or to not go to a church was like really unusual.
Well, and that was at a time where the Republican Party was not that dissimilar from the Democratic Party. They had a very small divide.
Oh, yeah.
Where now it's such a tremendous divide. Where do you see yourself today?
I really struggle with the presidential politics. I don't know who to vote for anymore. I mean, right now I can't vote for Donald Trump. I just find his sort of personality sort of appalling. It's funny when you kind of separate the person from the policies, I don't see, I mean, okay, maybe in the last 4 years, it has changed quite a bit. But prior to that, Democrats and Republicans sort of did many of the same things, even though they had very different ways to vocalize it. Right now, I prefer to be independent because I really don't want to be aligned with either party. I think both parties are, you know, having a lot of difficulties. And I'm hopeful that maybe, you know, through these kind of difficult times, as Americans, we'll figure out a path forward that's a lot better, because we tend to do that when things get bad.
Well, we're going to get back to present day, but I want to go first into how you evolved into the person you are. So when you were growing up, was there religion in the home?
Yeah, very much so. We had like devotions after dinner. We had to go to catechism. We had church twice on Sunday. And it was sort of mandated that we were going to Christian schools where your, you know, Bible classes are part of your curriculum. The good news is, you know, we had a lot of science in our home, and our tradition is very mainstream, science-driven. You know, we don't have some of this weird stuff I bumped into later in the evangelical and fundamentalist world.
Well, you call yourself an evangelical Christian, do you not?
maybe historically, I think that term is, I don't even like to use the term Christian anymore. I think those terms are so charged. So I think the historical concept of what an evangelical Christian is, an evangelical Christian could be Roman Catholic, could be Orthodox, could be Protestant, somebody who wants to spread the good news. I've always thought that was kind of a good idea. And I think when most people say evangelical today, what they really mean is fundamentalist. It's that hardcore right wing equating religion and politics and a lot of policies that come with it that I don't agree with. I want to be as far away from that as I possibly can. I went to Wheaton College, which is like they call themselves the Harvard of, you know, Christian colleges. It's like the pinnacle of evangelical Christianity.
Where is it?
It's in Chicago, Wheaton, Illinois. It's where Billy Graham went. It was the first college that was part of the Underground Railroad. It was the first college to admit black students, the first one to graduate black students. It was run by abolitionists. Did a lot of things
so
really
somewhat
well.
Somewhat of a liberal.
It's a liberal arts college. Okay. Yeah. And you know, it's funny how these things have changed. How what that used to mean was, hey, we're part of liberating slavery from the South. We're here for the equality of humanity. We're here for making sure that these people who don't look like us get the same education and the same benefits we get. A lot of those things have seemed to have left that organization.
Unfortunately. Yeah. Very
so
unfortunate.
That's why, so like, for example, I've written a lot about my alma mater and some of the big problems I see there, especially around race.
You growing up, I saw that you were kicked out of school 3 times.
In seventh grade, I think I was kicked out twice, once for a poem, once for having some vodka at a party. And then in college, I was finishing my third year at Wheaton College. I had finished my 2 majors. I had a semester left. And I was asked to leave the college over a poem that I had published. It may sound a little strange on the surface. I had good grades. I was an editor on the newspaper. I was the head of recreation at the school, which meant I organized the campus events. But I was at a school that was very conservative. We had to
always the life of a party.
Yeah, right. It hasn't changed. So yeah, so we had our own secret society called the Church of Reason. We were publishing our own underground newspaper called the Ice Cream Socialist and sort of making fun of ice cream socials at the school. And it was also a place where we could publish things that the school wouldn't let us publish. And so I had a poem published that was about surfing and had some sexual innuendo in it. And because the school couldn't catch me and my friends at the parties and the other things we were doing, they used the poem as the reason to kick me out. And because our official school newspaper, the Wheaton Record, was winning some non-daily awards with the Chicago Tribune, they saw that we were getting in trouble for publishing a newspaper at a liberal arts college. And they reached out and they said, what's going on? And we let them know. And then we staged some protests, became national news. It actually helped me get an internship with the American Enterprise Institute, which is a very, you know, competitive internship. It's an excellent think tank.
So this is your internship after high school?
This was during college. Yeah, I was in between my third and fourth year of college. I interned for Susie Garment, who was a op-ed page editor for the Wall Street Journal. And she was writing a book on political scandal at the time. And she chose me over a kid from Stanford because I had just had a scandal that was national news. I worked for Fred Upton that summer. And then I also worked at AEI. And it really helped me propel sort of my focus and interests. And I think the big sort of headline for me on all that was, did I deserve to get kicked out of Wheaton College? Oh, 100%, like 3 ways to Sunday. I think the reason they chose was really stupid. And the most important thing I learned was you need to take control of your story. You need to tell your version of this story and not let the school tell everybody what that version was.
What year did you get kicked out?
May of 1990.
But what was that, your junior year?
It was at the end of my third year, and I was already into my senior year because I would do summer programs, and you know, I actually studied archaeology in Israel in summer and different things. So yeah, so I was working ahead, but I was into my third year. So
did you get your degree?
I did. I finished at Calvin College, which is a Dutch Christian Reformed school in West Michigan, where my wife also went, Sarah.
And your degree was in philosophy?
One degree in philosophy and one in political science.
And you became this business guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so
get out of college.
I graduate college, 2 degrees. It's 1991. U.S. is in a recession. No one's hiring philosophers. And in Japan, they still had the bubble economy. And if you had a college degree, you can go over there and teach English and find work. And a friend's mom told us about it. So I borrowed some money from my dad, flew to Japan, never been to Japan, didn't eat sushi, didn't speak Japanese, navigating Japanese culture, figuring out how to get a job. It was all a little stressful, but very interesting. And then got a call to come back after less than a year to work at this think tank that I'd volunteered at in Grand Rapids when I was at Calvin to lead their PR and public affairs. Did that for a year, decided that it was small and I kind of wanted to get out of Grand Rapids. Started my own PR agency, just me, and started doing work for both political groups and for private groups at the same time. So I was doing work for term limits and that sort of thing. And then I also started picking up some technology clients. There was a laboratory in the Napa Valley that had read some of the stuff I'd published in the Foundation for Economic Education They liked my economic writing and work, and they asked if I could come help them with their marketing. So I was doing that at the same time. I was
no desire to actually run for any political office or get involved in the political
structure. I just sort of think it's the worst job on earth. But the crossroads for me was there's a very old economic think tank called the Foundation for Economic Education that has had a huge property just north of the city in New York on the Hudson River. And they asked me to come consider working there. The head of that was Hans Senholz, a famous Austrian economist at the time. And when I went to visit, everyone there was quite old. And I was in my 20s. He thought I was coming to start. And I was just coming for an interview just because I think he was losing it. And I went there, this beautiful, big estate, storied, you know, think tank, Austrian economics, which I love. And I looked at that and I was like, no, I was always thinking about the end. Like, is this where I want to end up? And I was like, this isn't it. Like, I want to do more than this. And so that was a crossroads for me. I was driving back across upstate New York. I remember stopping somewhere around the Finger Lakes. And I was just, it's like, I got to shift out of this. I want to be in business. I want to make money. I want to do something that can scale and that can really help people, you know, change their lives for the better, but do it in a way that has an economic driver to it. And that's when I made a big shift.
And is that when you got involved in multi-level marketing companies and training people how to become salespeople of their own?
Not exactly then. I started working with this laboratory up in the Napa Valley. So I had the opportunity to go to New York or California. And I was like, I'm going to work in St. Helena. I live in the Napa Valley. I love surfing. And I always wanted to get back. My goal was to get to the West Coast somehow. I went to the Napa Valley, was working for the owner of this laboratory, helping him grow his business.
And what was that business?
It's called ETS Laboratories. So they do a lot of most of the major analytical work for wineries, breweries, and distilleries. Like, for example, if our ethanol numbers were different than the alcohol, tobacco, firearms, ATF's numbers, they'd ask us what they did wrong because the lab is really well respected.
So chemist.
It's chemistry and biology. Yeah. When I worked in Japan, I was writing a lot about technology and biotechnology. And so between my economics work and my bio and technology writing, it was kind of a natural combination. So I was working with him. We were flying up to Washington State to visit. U.S. Tobacco owned three big wineries at the time that were clients of ours, Columbia Crest, Canoe Ridge, Chateau St. Michel. And as we were flying up there, this guy sits next to me and the owner was sitting across the aisle from me on the plane. I'm in my 20s. This couple are sitting inside for me. And the guy says to me, he's like, so what do you do for a living? He starts asking me questions. And you know, I'm talking. He asked me, do you make all the money you want to make? And I said, well, nobody makes all the money they want to make. Bill Gates doesn't make all the money he wants to make. It's kind of a dumb question. And he's obviously chatting me up for a reason. And his wife closes this folder. And on the front of the folder, it says Amway. Huh. And I said to him, I go, oh, are you guys affiliated with Amway? And his like whole demeanor changed. He was like, well, what do you know about Amway? You know, kind of thing.
Well, tell us about Amway.
Right. So the funny backstory is my dad's uncle, my great uncle, Jay Van Andel, is one of the co-founders of Amway, which is one of the earliest and largest direct seller in the world. And so I didn't really have any bad impressions of Amway. I didn't really know what Amway distributors did. I just knew that my cousins, the Van Andels, had been, you know, hugely successful. They're a billionaire family. Rich DeVos and Jay Van Andel started out as Nutrilite distributors, one of the first supplement companies. It's 90 years old now. That was started out here.
Oh, I remember Nutrilite.
Yeah, wow. It's started here. It's a $4 billion part of their business today. But they started out here in Newport Beach. And
is it somewhat like Herbalife?
It's sort of similar. Yeah, it's supplements, right? So Rich and Jay started as post-World War II, started out as Nutrilite distributors, were successful. Nutrilite had problems, couldn't pay distributors, couldn't give them products. And so they decided to start their own direct selling company with other distributors from Nutrilite. They didn't stop doing Nutrilite. They just started Amway, what became Amway. So my great-grandfather in West Michigan who immigrated, he had a grocery store. And one of the things that he figured out was that everybody needed soap. And so back then, things came in on train cars. There was one kind of soap that everybody would use called American Family Soap. Didn't have all these different detergents back then. He would buy the whole train car. And so if you wanted soap in Grand Rapids, you had to come to my great-grandfather's store, which made him a very popular grocer. And so when Rich and Jay were starting that company, my grandfather, who ran a brass foundry, said to them, if you really want to do something unique and special, find a soap that can help break through with a woman at home who's trying to clean the house. Because at that time in the 50s and early 60s, women were still largely at home, taking care of the household. And so that was kind of the origin of Amway. They started with some breakthrough cleaning products that were organic that came out of the auto industry that actually cleaned much better than normal cleaning products you found. And people sold that door to door.
So you're talking about being on the plane and meeting these people that are involved with Amway.
He started sharing what they did. And I had a curiosity. And so Sarah and I, before we had our son Skylar, joined Amway as Amway distributors. And we started out building a business just like everybody else. Basically, you would have some customers that you would sell to and make a little markup. And then you would also aggregate other distributors who were buying at wholesale and reselling. And that total volume gives you a bonus at the end of the month.
Is it a little pyramid-y?
That's a great question. You know, so a pyramid scheme is a term for something that's illegal.
Right.
And that means that like a Ponzi scheme, right? That means that the person who's at the top makes all the money and the people at the bottom make very little and have no chance to do it. And those are illegal. A direct selling company is structured, frankly, like any corporation. Every human organization is a pyramid. Church, club, right? There's somebody at the top who runs it. Then there's subsets below, and there's people at the bottom. I think the thing that's really unique and special about Amway is the way that you make a lot of money in Amway is if I help somebody make dollars, I'll make nickels and dimes. To be successful, it's not about selling. It's about helping people understand how it works and helping them be successful. And then when they're successful, you're going to get a small residual on that. And so I think that's actually pretty healthy. It's why they've endured and, you know, do tens of billions of dollars a year. So, we learned about the business that way. And then I was also very entrepreneurial outside of the Amway business and was active in technology and different things. And after the dot-com meltdown, I was helping a new nutrition company down here fix their website and do some other things. And I'd owned a Red Bull distributorship as part of a large dot-com in the late 90s. And as they were trying to fix their nutrition business, you know, one of the things I said is, well, you know, you've got powders and bars. Why not make an energy drink? That's a hot category right now. Red Bull was blowing up. And so at that company, Logic Nutrition, we pioneered and made the first energy drink. We branded it XS. That was the first one to be sugar-free. It was the first one to use mega doses of B12. We also made flavors that tasted great. So it was something that you would enjoy that was actually pretty good for you. Something that I would enjoy drinking every day. My family could drink every day.
And you co-founded this company.
I was part of the team that created it at Logic Nutrition. Eventually, we pulled it out of Logic Nutrition and co-founded a company called XS Worldwide that we launched exclusively with Amway in 2003.
And that was an energy drink.
That was an energy drink in two flavors that we started with. Yeah.
Okay.
Excess energy drinks.
And Amway, when you say .com, was the Amway somehow tied into this .com?
No, I was doing that totally separately. So we lived in the Bay Area. I started with, you know, ETS Labs, got more and more involved in technology, ended up working in consulting services in technology and rolling out a lot of computer networks and doing software development at large companies, Fortune 100 companies like Kaiser Permanente, The Gap, et cetera.
And what's your training in the computer technology?
I started coding when I was in grade school.
Okay.
And I was lucky enough to go to schools where that was important. We had pet computers
early
where
we were on with
coding
the computers.
Basic with like cassette tapes. My dad brought home an Apple II in, geez, I don't know, probably late 70s.
So you're incredible. You're involved in politics. You're involved in computers. You're involved in these vertical industries. Did you ever find your calling? And when did you find yourself?
Yeah, I think so. So the organizing principle behind it, I think for me, is the thing I found in philosophy when I was studying that I really fell in love with was phenomenology. And that is all about understanding experience. What am I truly experiencing? How am I experiencing that? How is that phenomena hitting my receptors that I'm seeing it that way? And that kind of got me excited about psychedelics because they disrupt a lot of that. So you see things very differently, like with fresh eyes. And it got me interested in a lot of other ideas that way, like spirituality. Like, okay, I know the construct's cold. I know the religions pretty well. I was raised in that stuff. When you can kind of wipe that stuff aside and get to the source, get to the thing itself, get to the raw experience, I think that's what actually matters. That's what's really interesting. And so whether it was coding computers, you know, that's all about constructs. Whether it's working in politics, seeing that game, whether it's, you know, business, understanding that game, or nutrition, you know, which I've been involved with, you know, how do you popularize? There's so many cool ingredients that can really help change people's lives in the right concentrations if they use them enough. But how do you get people to do that? It's so hard to create new habits unless people enjoy something. And so for me, like, and this is where like I got involved in marketing and communications around PR and that sort of thing. I you know, Dutch tolerance, I know what I believe. I know what I like. How do I communicate to somebody else so that they see it, so that they might appreciate it? Maybe they don't agree with me, but they appreciate the idea. How do you build that bridge?
Such a usable tool.
Yeah.
Such a usable tool.
And it makes your life better.
Well, it's just so usable in every aspect of careers and building a nutritional company.
It's broadly applicable. Yeah, you can use it anywhere. Yeah.
To answer my original question, I think you found yourself as a philosopher.
Yeah, so I think it's applied philosophy, right? It's how do you apply this idea of enjoyment and experience to these different verticals? And that's where I've kind of
lived my
life.
So you truly are a philosopher. To me, when I'm sitting here having conversations,
maybe
you are
an applied philosopher. Yeah,
applied.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because your perspectives, you know, have a very vast perspective on everything, on life, on computers, on politics.
I'm very curious.
And you're very curious. And I think that makes a beautiful open mind.
Thank you.
Especially if you're so well-traveled.
I hope
on
so.
On top of it.
Yeah. I mean, that was the fun with Excess. We were in 60 countries. So I used to travel 10 months a year and go around the world, you know, 10 or 12 times
and
a year.
And is Excess the company that you then sold to Amway?
Yeah. So we sold that to Amway in 2015. And then part of the deal was I had to run it for them for 3 years and integrate it into their business. We were able to grow to, you know, almost 60 countries, over $400 million and launched a whole new sports nutrition line and really, you know, had a ton of fun. My job was to, you know, throw a lot of parties and do a lot of big outdoor events and launch a lot of cool new products. After I left Excess, I'd been working in private equity and operating at a couple different companies. I met the people at Nirvana Super, particularly Dr. Naji Aboumrad, who's at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, who discovered this ingredient called HMB, beta-hydroxybetamate-butyrate. It's a byproduct of leucine synthesis. Leucine's a major amino acid. So I kind of spent about a year talking to him, looking at the science, and I really liked the science. The business wasn't ready for prime time yet. And eventually the chairman got me to agree to come on and run that business as the CEO. So about a year ago, I joined Nirvana Water Sciences, became their CEO, and we brought a new team and transformed the business, the product, the portfolio, and we're having a lot of fun right now. We make three flavored spring waters with HMB plus D in it. We have three seltzers, energy seltzers with HMB plus D and two beverage shots.
What's the brand name?
It's Nirvana Super.
Nirvana Super.
And then we also launched Nirvana Super Pro, which we're selling to doctors. So it's a new orthopedic surgery protocol to build lean muscle mass before an orthopedic surgery and to preserve lean muscle mass post-surgery to enhance surgical outcomes.
Fantastic. Well, I'm definitely excited to try it. And I want to go back to just more fun stuff.
Sure.
Like you are this avid surfer, and I was going to tell everybody how you became a surfer and, you know, because you grew up in the Midwest.
Yeah, exactly.
So where does one catch a surf in the Midwest again?
My dad loves sailing. We grew up on a lake next to a little yacht club, and we grew up racing sailboats. And my brother and I started going from racing sailboats to racing windsurfers. And then we start breaking our equipment out in these big storms in the Great Lakes. So we started surfing. The Great Lakes can get very big waves. If you think about the song about the Edmund Fitzgerald, I think that was a 700-foot freighter that got split in half on Lake Superior, right? It's the violent storms that cross the United States, accelerate when they hit that water, and we get big storms that pop up quickly. So I grew up surfing on the Great Lakes and sort of violent storms, kind of crazy, but it was a lot of fun. My brother and I and our friends did it. We actually made a movie called Unsalted that was on NBC and stuff that was all about the violent storms in the Great Lakes and the surfers who chased them. So that's where we started, but then we traveled a lot. So we'd take surfboards with us. And then my college roommate, Mark Metherell, is from Laguna Beach. So we'd go back to Emerald Bay, you know, at spring break and surf Southern California. And, by the time I was out of college, I don't know, I'd surfed Israel, I'd surfed Japan, I'd surfed the West Coast, the East Coast, the Caribbean. Surfing for me was a really fun way to travel and to see the world and discover new cultures and to find things in common with people you didn't know.
And do you find it meditative to be out there?
Generally, yes. I think the best thing about surfing when it's at its height is that you focus on the surfing and you enjoy being in the water, and that's why you're out there. Sometimes you're in crowded lineups where people can get a little difficult, and then it can be not so fun. But I think when it's at its height, it's when people are learning to enjoy their surroundings and the environment, nature, and really focus on what they're doing with nature.
Would you feel that's when you're most present?
Yes.
Yeah.
And free diving too. Like I love free diving for the same reason.
Do you spearfish when you're free diving?
I used to. Now Laguna is a marine preserve. So But what I do now is I hunt for abalone shells. And we work with Nancy Caruso, who's a marine biologist here in Laguna Beach. They plant baby abalone, you know, they're replenishing that. They plant kelp forests. And so we help her keep track of where the abalone are. And when we find shells, we let her know that we found, you know, shells here or there. And I love breath hold diving.
Well, I read that you can hold your breath up to 5 minutes. Is this true?
Yeah, in certain conditions. Yeah. So the breath hold is complicated, but yeah, if I'm doing, for example, Wim Hof breathing and I'm putting myself in a oxygen rich CO2 deprivation state, I can hold my breath for probably, 5 minutes or more.
You are as well a writer.
I am.
And you've penned some articles for a few periodicals that we've all heard of, such as Huffington Post, Sojourner, and Laguna Beach Independent.
Yeah, I had a column here locally for a few years.
And what was the subject matter?
I had a column called Local Currents, and it was basically local events that I chose to write about. Typically, it was something somewhat locally political. I actually think local politics is probably the most important politics. But, you know, two of the big issues that we took on was downhill skateboarding, which may sound strange to people outside Laguna, but it was a big deal at the time here. And also the social host ordinance. The school board was doing what a lot of school boards were doing at the time, which was trying to create new laws around what parents could do in their home with their kids and giving police broader powers to enter your home if they felt like it, if they thought maybe a party was going on.
This was what, about 10 years ago?
Yeah. And it's when my kids were in high school.
So the social host ordinance is about how your kids entertain other kids in the home?
Yeah. The idea is that parents should not be buying alcohol for kids and throwing parties in their home, which I think most of us tend to agree with to a degree, right? And part of what the extension of the rule was you could be not even at home. You could be traveling. It might not even be your kids. Somebody could break into your home and throw a party and they would still hold you accountable for the event that happened there. And that just seemed like overreach to me. And we were able to basically, the school came to us and said, would you write the social host ordinance, which we did. And the way that we changed the law was that if you hosted a party and an officer legally entered your home and told you to stop serving alcohol to kids who weren't your own and you refused to stop service, then you would get a ticket. And we thought that was pretty reasonable.
Right. When we would host, we would just, you know, we weren't offering alcohol to underage kids or anything, but you knew that someone was going to sneak it in.
Of course.
So we had beepers on the doors.
Yeah.
Every door and window that opened and closed would go beep, beep. And we would take the keys. And if you weren't going to give me the keys to your car, then you were needing to get in a cab or pick your car up the next day.
Right.
Because I didn't want anybody in my house that wouldn't hand me the keys to their car. What if I was going to go to sleep and someone was going to drive away? You just have to be mindful of youth and that youthful energy and that 100%. Desire to try things. And it's inevitable, like you said. And you are involved in charities as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was kind of bred into us. Like, you know, the way I was raised, you sort of set aside 10% for charity. I'm less rigorous about the percentage, but it's more about, you know, the values and the cause and is it really making an impact? We come from this tradition where we believe that if there is this God, that this God is fundamentally based in love and it's a generous, loving God, right? And so if you start from that foundation, then you're supposed to live generously, right? You're supposed to give back because it's not yours. You didn't create it. You somehow are a steward of these things. And so I was raised even as a kid that you're always putting 10% in. You're always giving 10% back. And
it's funny that you say 10%. Sorry, not to cut you off there, but I grew up hearing my mom say that. And she's a Sephardic Jew. And I remember her saying, we're responsible to at least contribute 10%.
It's an Abrahamic concept, right? It comes from the Bible, from Abraham, about giving a tithe or a tenth.
Wonderful. And you were raised with spirituality or a spiritual leader in your home, no?
Sure. Yeah, my parents, my dad was always like an elder in the church or he was on the school board and things. And my mother was very active in that sort of stuff too.
So that's where you say you believed in science, but you had this religion in the home because your father was a doctor, I heard you say.
Yeah. I mean, he went to Johns Hopkins, you know.
So a doctor and a devout.
I think science and religion don't have to be at odds. That whatever the energy is that powers the universe, wherever that came from, whatever that you know, explosive event that caused everything to come into being, if there is a power behind it, hopefully it's based in love. Hopefully it's generous. Hopefully, it wants us to be happy And I think our opportunity as human beings is to put meaning into the universe. You know, the universe is going to not be nice to us. I tell people when we go in the ocean, the ocean doesn't care about you. You need to learn the rhythms of it, how to dance with it, how to participate in it. But if you get on the wrong side of it, it can literally kill you, right? And I think the universe is that way, that our opportunity is to engage it, to embrace it, to learn to dance with it. And when you find harmony with it, wonderful things can happen. And that's where I think we all excel.
How do you reckon with, though, so many different perspectives on religion and how much it feels like it creates division in many ways?
Yeah.
Because my religion is accurate, but yours isn't. And
it's silly.
Usually it's so divisive.
To me, it's flavors. Muslim, Christian, Jewish. We all claim Abraham. We all agree that Abraham had one God. So what our particular views of what that God is are kind of irrelevant. We can all agree that it's the same God, right? And some people would be like, well, I'm Hindu or, you know, whatever. That's fine too. At the root, it's all from the same source. All truth. If we believe that there is if people believe that there is one God, then there is only one truth. And that truth is going to permeate all of culture, all of creation, all of society, all of everything. And so my question isn't, what flavor of it do you like? You know, and making energy drinks all over the world, you learn really quick that you're going to be wrong. My favorite flavor is root beer.
My favorite.
See, and we're right.
Of course.
But, you know,
the best.
But most people in the world will not like root beer. And so when I would travel to other countries, the real question for me wasn't, do you like root beer? Or can I talk you into root beer? It was, what are your favorite flavors? How can we make some new, exciting, innovative flavors here that'll be really exciting in your culture? How do we build bridges here? And I think it's the same with religion. I think it's the same with, you know, how do I understand what you really want and what you're trying to accomplish and help you get that? Because you probably want most of the same things that I do at the bottom of it. It just might be a different version or flavor.
Well, I want to move on because you've given us so much time and it's such an honor and I appreciate it.
Thank you.
So I don't want to steal too much more of your time. I do want to ask you just a couple more things about our country today. Since we're called Democratic, we do like to talk about what's going on around us here in America.
Sure.
Democracy. How do you feel right now about the political landscape in America?
I think our biggest problem is we aren't a nation anymore. My biggest concern is that we have another civil war. I really feel like we're at this point where people are living in two different realities. I primarily blame the 24-hour news cycle. I think our bipartisan leaders are not serving us very well in terms of building consensus, figuring out how to work together. And it starts with the president, starts with the leader of the House and the Senate. I also think the Supreme Court has become horribly politicized in ways that are sort of unconscionable. It used to be that the Supreme Court was very collegial and tried to behave so it wasn't political. I feel like we've lost that. And when you lose that, you lose respect for it. When you lose respect for it, if you don't have respect for government, then what do you really have? And so I'm very concerned about that right now.
Do you keep a home in Paris, France, because you feel you may want to be out of the United States in the event that something takes place, such as a civil war type of event?
I mean, not really. I appreciate that people want multiple passports. I wouldn't mind having multiple passports. We love living in Paris because it's Paris. And I was working over there and running a business over in Europe. You know, look, every country has its own problems. I mean, I think when people are afraid, they give up their rights to a dictator. And I'm very concerned that that could happen here. And my problem with populist leaders like Donald Trump is they're not leading from a sense of law and respect for the Constitution. It's sort of a megalomania. And
not sort of. It is megalomania.
I'm not a psychologist, but it almost appears to be a narcissistic disorder that he's unaware of, I would say. I certainly don't want to see our military have to take action against our president, which I think almost happened on January 6th. And I'm hopeful that we can get back to respecting a constitution, even if we disagree about how we apply it. And that when the Supreme Court or the Congress either passes a law or interprets a law, that we can at least respect that that's the law we're living under, whether we necessarily agree with it or not. And that problem happens pretty much everywhere. Whether you're in Canada, Germany, France, Japan, every country has its own problems. I love America and I want America to truly be a land that helps everybody get the maximum liberty they can have and celebrate that. And that I think that's the one value that we die for in this country. And I think that's the one that we need to make sure that we preserve.
Well, I'm with you there. I love America. I have not sought alternative citizenship. It hasn't really been a thing that's been weighing on me. I am concerned about our country, but I am an optimist, and I think good will prevail.
I agree.
And I wanted to ask you, what, if anything, makes you feel optimistic about the future of our country?
So I happen to believe, I'm very optimistic about humanity. You know, there was this premise, it's called the Malthusian premise. It's by a philosopher named Malthus who believed that there was a set number of people who could inhabit the earth. When we got to that number, you know, it would all end more or less. What sort of overturned the Malthusian premise is that the most populated countries on earth are also the most successful. You know, it's relative, so sometimes it's hard to see, but India, which has an accelerating population, was also accelerating growth and prosperity in that country. And the physical quality of life indexes, as populations scale, get better. As populations decline, it gets worse. I believe that that's because humans have this innate creative power to create wealth and to add value to this world and to create great meaning and purpose. And, you know, we can also do horrible things. And I'm hopeful that we'll learn from those things and we will continue to grow and change and get better, even though we make mistakes along the way.
Well, thank you for that. And thank you again for being here and honoring us with your time and your story.
Always happy to do this. Thank you for inviting me. It's an honor when somebody wants to hear a story from me about my life. And it's very humbling. And I appreciate that you thought I'm worthy of Debra Craddock. This has been a great experience.
This episode of Debra Craddock was hosted by me, Debra Drucker. It was produced by Lee Rocker with co-production and editing by Gideon Brower. Our amazing music was performed by Amy Nelson and Kathy Guthrie of Folk Uke. Be sure to rate and review this episode wherever you listen to podcasts. For more Debra Craddock, check out DebraCraddock.com and our Instagram at Debra Craddock. That's DebraH Craddock, like Democratic. Until next time.
Political is personal, so let's talk about it. We've been there, we've had it. It's all